Welcome everyone to one of our BJJ podcasts for the month of April. I'm Andrew Duckworth and a warm welcome back to you all from your team here at the Bone and Joint Journal. As always, we'd like to thank you all for your continued comments and support, as well as a big gratitude to our many authors and colleagues who took part in the series that highlights some of the great work published by our authors each month. So for today's podcast, I have the pleasure of being joined by two authors from an annotation published in this month's edition of the BJJ entitled Thromboprophylaxis for the Trauma and Orthopaedic Surgeon, Tribulation and Trials. So firstly, I'm very pleased to be joined by Professor Dan Horner. He's a consultant in emergency and critical care medicine in Salford. Thanks for joining us, Dan. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you, and thanks for the kind invite.
And secondly, I'm pleased to welcome back Dan's co-author, Professor Xavier Griffin, who is the Professor of Orthopaedic and Trauma Surgery at Queen Mary University in London. Xavier, great to have you back with us, as always.
Thanks very much. Pleased to be here.
So, Dan, maybe if I could start with yourself, your annotation, as we've said, Thromboprophylaxis for the Trauma and Orthopaedic Surgeon. I suppose a quick question first up, and I think it'll be of interest to our listeners. As an emergency medicine consultant, what's your sort of take on this topic? Where do you come from the non-orthopaedic point of view?
Yeah, so probably worth digging into a bit of my history with ETE. I took a couple of years out of program for research as a mid-level registrar when I was pursuing a career in emergency medicine. And my MD topic, I suppose, was VTE and particularly distal deep vein thrombosis. But as always, when you take on an academic project, other projects seem to appear out of nowhere and are placed on your desk. And one of those was the challenge of what we do about thromboprophylaxis for patients in lower limb immobilization. And we had a couple of index very sad cases in the emergency department, and as you and your listeners will know, VTE continues to be a challenge for all of us. It's a diagnostic difficulty sometimes. PE still has a case fatality rate somewhere between 10-20%, depending on the timing that you look at, either 28 days or a year. So we kind of banged our heads together about that in the Royal College of Emergency Medicine. We looked at the evidence base. We realized that was real variation in international practice, and that's what first got me interested, I suppose, in the particular subject of thromboprophylaxis in lower limb immobilization.
That's really interesting. And in terms of, you mentioned that about the variation in practice, that is something that is really there, isn't it? There's various protocols from various centres, from various trusts, and there isn't really a standardisation across the board. Would you say that's fair?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think perhaps the biggest evidence of that variation is difference between us and North America. I think most US hematology guidelines don't particularly endorse the practice of thromboprophylaxis for ambulatory patients with lower limb immobilization, whereas in a lot of European countries like France and Belgium, it's default essentially, and the UK settles somewhere in between, basing its practice on risk assessment. But as you say, then that leads to variation because people use different risk assessment models. They have different percentages of prescribing rates, and some hospitals even use different drugs for it. So a lot of that reflects, I would suggest, the underlying lack of evidence. You know, that's something we wanted to highlight in this paper, and that's something we're trying to tackle with the TALIS study, which I'll come on to later.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, we definitely will go on to those things, and it'd be great to talk about TILI as well. But Xavier, if I maybe come to yourself, you know, can I maybe, you know, again, your own clinical experiences with this topic, and then move on, maybe talk about where you think we are with the current guidance on it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I predominantly practice in trauma, and I do a little bit of arthroplasty, low limb arthroplasty works. I have seen the two sides of the coin, as most of our colleagues listening today will have done, where we occasionally see DVTs and pulmonary embolus, particularly in multiple injured patients. And so there's a real burden of clots, perhaps not, from our perception, the same degree as the hematologists are seeing, because they're clearly seeing a clinic workload which is all made up of people with clots. But we also see the flip side of it, and perhaps that doesn't reach through into other medical specialties, which is, or at least inpatient specialties, which is the bleeding side. And often if the bleeding is not catastrophic, if it's wound-related, particularly incisional wounds, then, you know, we run into problems with washing those wounds out, potentially infection. And I know there's a great fear that some of the anticoagulants that are used might increase the risk of those sorts of complications, which in the case of arthroplasty is a complete catastrophe for the patient, an infected arthroplasty. So I think it's a really difficult area because those two different types of risks are very different, and they're probably in the ballpark of similarly common, I would say, overall, across all populations, and the consequences can be catastrophic on both sides. And and trying to peel apart what the best thing to do for individuals in front of you, I think is really
difficult. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think actually that's that equipoise we all throw in the round, isn't it? Is that risk of, like you say, of VT, which is a real thing, but also that risk of, like you say, if you get a hematoma after an arthroplasty and then that gets infected, it's an equal disaster in many ways. So that's very well put. And in terms of, you know, you mentioned in your annotation about the NICE guidance in 2019, what did that sort of very briefly recommend, or was there anything you would want our listeners to know?
Yeah, difficult to be brief about that NICE guidance. Mike Reed, who was on, so we had an orthopedic subcommittee which made up of some really stellar people, and Mike took a picture, which I've used many times and I'm grateful to him, Mike Reed, of the entire document printed out on a desk, and it's several volumes thick. So it's difficult to be brief about it, but I think there's a few things that, when I was thinking about this, is what are the key messages. The first is that VT is a real phenomenon, but the degree to which that we might be able to change mortality following VTE is highly contentious. And so we phrase the introductory text to make it clear that we believe that it's potentially a modifiable event, mortality following PE. And it's difficult because the trials are relatively small. They're a few thousand patients, and PE is very uncommon, and mortality following PE even less common. And so the trials typically are not powered to look for that as an outcome. Mm-hmm. They're typically powered to look for DVT, mm-hmm. and historically ultrasound-proven DVT rather than clinical symptomatic DVT. And so we made the assumption that if you could reduce the DVT risk, then that would translate into reducing the more severe but less frequent complications. But it is an assumption, and that's laid out at the beginning of the NICE guidance. And then the other two things I would say is that we did incorporate a lot of orthopedic data from the National Joint Registry linked with the hospital episode statistics. And that's why you see so many changes between the previous iteration and this iteration, because we were able to incorporate much more real-world estimates of the real risk, and then use the trials to update the relative benefits of the drugs.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, I guess the final thing I would say is that the absolute risk is very variable across different populations. So translating benefits into real risk improvements for patients in numbers that mean something, like, you know, your risk goes down by 2 in 100 or whatever it is, that's really important. And so you must read NICE with a view to your particular population. And that's why the NICE guidance is laid out in that way, because some people have got less than 1% risk and other people in the same guidance have got 40 and 50% risk.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, I know it was a big document. That was a really nice overview. And I think actually, like you say, the key points that people need to take into account when they're looking at it. So maybe, Dan, if I could come back to you, and maybe if we maybe change tack a little, well, become a bit more specific, if we move on to the sort of a key area, you know, of lower limb fracture surgery and immobilization, which, you know, we're all involved with. What are the current thoughts and practices with regards the sort of risk assessment models? We sort of mentioned that already, but it would just wonder if we could go in a bit more detail with that.
Yeah, so I think the premise of risk assessment is a very logical one, isn't it? And Xavier's really eloquently highlighted the trade-off here between prevention of VTE whilst also trying to mitigate the costs and potential harms of using a drug for a low event rate population. The challenge with risk assessment is that it's very badly studied and derived. Lower limb immobilization is a very good example of that. So there's numerous scores that abound internationally. If you look in detail at them, there's very little validation work, very little work on reliability, hardly any implementation work. So, you know, hardly any studies looking at the introduction of a score compared to the gestalt of an emergency or an orthopedic surgeon. So, you know, we tend to grasp risk assessment quite quickly, but often without the same kind of reliable evidence base that or critique that we would apply to trial data when we're considering whether or not to use a drug or an intervention. We were commissioned by NIHR to look at this really with a systematic review of risk assessment tools and a decision analysis model in 2018-2019. We found, you know, the evidence for risk assessment tools to be very, very weak. But interestingly, the decision analysis model and the cost effectiveness work did suggest that thromboprophylaxis was likely to be overall cost effective based on the estimates of relative risk reduction using thromboprophylaxis. I know we can talk about that in more detail if you like, but again, that was a fairly lengthy document. Since then, there's been a number of kind of slightly more refined and better validated risk assessment models published. And I don't know, I suspect many of your readers might have seen the recent publication in The Lancet, I think it was this month, looking at the evaluation of the TripCast score in this particular population. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the better studies in this area, really. A group from France and Belgium looking at step wedge was a randomized trial where they assigned different sites to continue their normal practice and then interject use of the TripCast risk assessment model for this particular clinical situation and based thromboprophylaxis prescribing decisions on that. And yes, the suggestion from that paper is that TripCast is probably one of the better models, that it can reduce the amount of thromboprophylaxis we use, that it had a relatively high accuracy, and that in the right hands it might be good. And luckily enough, that's the risk assessment model we've chosen for TILI, because we've been working with Delphine Doulier, who's the lead author for that Lancet study as part of the NIH application. So we've evolved, I would say, from where we started in 2012 with the Royal College of Emergency Medicine GEMNET guidance on this, which was essentially, good old people around a table trying to decide what they thought might incur risk, highlight that in some sort of pro forma. I know John Keenan and others, from orthopedic surgery have introduced rules like the Plymouth Rule, they're used in certain geographical locations. But I think we've kind of gone through that work. We've now got to slightly more reliable and better validated scores. And we're now using those to discern risk in randomized controlled trials, which is really what we need to be sure.
That's a really nice overview, Dan. I think, like you say about the TripCast score in that study, I think what you really nicely highlight is that, and I think probably it's reassuring, I suppose, to an orthopedic surgeon, is actually that it could potentially reduce the amount of chemoprophylaxis we may need to use. And I think that's the thing, is it's actually finding who we need to use it in, isn't it, as much as anything. And I think if we get a really good score like that, or we hope to have like that, that's one of the keys to it. And maybe, Zari, if I come to you, sort of moving on from that, when we're talking about lower limb surgery and immobilization, there's two sort of recent RCTs you highlight in that area. That's the prophylaxis in non-major orthopedic surgery, and then the PREVENT CLOT trial. Can you just sort of summarize again what they really showed and what the listeners should take home from those?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, both these trials are top end, out the gate, stellar pieces of work. And we are, I would say we are duty bound to dig into these and understand them and apply them in our practice as best we can, because the quality of these data is fabulous. So they're both around largely fracture-related populations, and they're both what's called a non-inferiority design study, which is a really important consideration when you're thinking about what this means for your practice. So we're not asking, is one treatment better than the other? We're asking the question, is one treatment no worse than the standard of care? So it's our new test treatment, not worse than the standard of care. And it's an appropriate design if you've got a standard of care which is expensive or really cumbersome for the patient to use or unpleasant or has a lot of side effects. And what you're searching around for is something that is not worse in terms of its effectiveness at reducing the clot risk, but is more amenable in some way. And because low molecular heparin is our standard of care typically for fracture surgery and lower limb fracture surgery, the patients hate it. And it's actually quite expensive because a proportion of patients can't self-administer. And so when you work out the cost associated with low molecular heparin, it's quite pricey, much more expensive than the actual cost of the drug when the health economists spin up those costs with nurse administration and things. So I think it's an appropriate design, but it's got a bad reputation, because if you design a study which is looking for a benefit, the worst case scenario is you fail to find a true benefit and you default back to what you were starting with, which was probably safe and relatively effective. But if you ask the question in a way that is not necessarily ideal about is it not worse, then you can make a conclusion that it's not worse, even if it is worse. And this starts to get a bit complicated because the terminology is horrible. But non-inferiority designs need to be really cautious, because you can incorrectly come to the conclusion that we'll switch to this different treatment because it's no worse. And I think these two trials illustrate that really nicely. So Chronomos is non-major orthopedic surgery, but it's mostly low limb fracture surgery. And they said, okay, our control group, our standard of care is low molecular weight heparin. We want to know whether an oral anticoagulant, which in this case was rivaroxaban, is not worse in terms of producing clot. And so they looked at PE-related death, DVTs, proximal DVTs. It was all clinically based. It wasn't driven by ultrasounds. It was in thousands of patients. And they found really, really obviously that it was not inferior, didn't cause any more bleeding. Mm. And then when they did a subsequent secondary test to see, is it actually better in terms of reducing blood, they found it was better. And they did a really lovely comparison right at the end, which was they lumped together all the bleeds and all the clots in the two groups. And they showed that even when you take into account bleeding and clotting in the two groups, you get a net clinical benefit with rivaroxaban. So you get fewer bleeds and you get fewer clots. So overall, your patients are about a 50% reduction in bad outcomes. Now, prevent clot is a different question. Now they were saying, okay, well, our standard of care is low molecular weight heparin, but, you know, we don't really believe necessarily that we need to give heparins or DOACs. I think aspirin is just as good. So we're asking the question, is aspirin, which is cheaper and oral and more amenable for patients, is that not worse? But here, they did something that was really important. They looked at the outcome of mortality, all-cause mortality. If you've got a treatment that we don't think really changes mortality, and I said that right at the beginning in the NICE guidance, that we know that our trials are not really adequately powered to look for big differences in mortality because it's really uncommon death. If you set the trial up to find a difference in an outcome that you don't really think gets changed, you skew the trial to finding a positive finding for non-inferiority. And so what they found was it doesn't change death. It's non-inferior for death. And therefore, they said aspirin was safe. When you dig into the secondary outcome measures, it's about double the risk of proximal DVT. But of course, the primary analysis and what the whole trial is geared up for in the discussion is all around death.
Yeah.
So I am nervous that prevent clot, because of the way it was designed, it's still a lovely trial. It's beautifully reported. You've got to understand that the question is all around mortality. And if you don't really think it changes mortality, why would you ask the question around mortality?
Yeah, that's a really interesting take on it. I mean, I think actually, like you say, the importance of actually delving a little bit deeper to those other secondary outcomes, so to speak, but actually are very important. So Dan, if I maybe come back to you in terms of, obviously we're talking about that, a lot of that was about lower limb fracture surgery. There's also some data about lower limb immobilization after injury as well, isn't there? And there's some recent studies in that area which are probably worth highlighting as well that you discuss in your annotation.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, just to sort of pick up the point about death in particular as well, if I may, as an emergency and critical care physician, I suppose I would argue that, you know, a lot of VT outcomes are later down the line in these kind of studies. And actually, we have fairly robust pathways within NHS care, certainly to diagnose and to treat VT. So looking only at those mortality episodes, you know, gets you really down into the very, very fine detail of outcomes. Sure. But there are lots of other things that patients can experience which are bad related to VT.
Yeah.
Moving on to the sort of specific trial data around lower limb immobilization in ambulatory patients, so these patients who are put into some form of immobilization and discharged from hospital. I think we talk about podcast in the annotation, which was a great trial, again, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Authors from the Netherlands really looking across multiple sites and randomizing patients to low molecular weight heparin versus no pharmacological intervention and finding no real difference in the incidence of symptomatic VTE between those two groups. It kind of shone a real light on the discussion around whether these patients need any kind of thromboprophylaxis. When you look at the detail of that trial, I suppose the concerns from the thrombosis community were around the open label design, some of the strict exclusion criteria. So people with previous VT were excluded, people with any kind of recent active cancer were excluded, there were other exclusions. So you really drill down then onto a very low risk cohort that perhaps don't stand to benefit. And the worry always, I suppose, is that when people generalize this kind of findings to the broader population, you end up with, you know, people with very high VT risk who are then, I suppose, denied thromboprophylaxis, for want of a better word, because of the single trial that excluded their type of population. And then the dosing used was actually lower than we would use in the UK. So, you know, is it externally generalizable? I suppose some questions around there that we just need to bear in mind. And interestingly, when you put podcast alongside other trials on this topic, you do still see a net clinical benefit or evidence of clinical effectiveness for thromboprophylaxis. So a recent updated Cochrane review, you know, will tell you that thromboprophylaxis reduces the overall risk of VTE, as will our systematic review published, as will the NIHR monograph published in 2019. So, you know, podcast is one trial amongst many, and I think we probably need to look at the body of evidence overall.
Yeah, no, so, and I think and that's a really important point you raised there, Dan. I'm talking about the inclusion exclusion criteria. I know they're very important for any trial, but I think particularly for these, that, you know, even with we're talking about the Peronomas trial, you know, there was a comment, you know, you make about how they were a relatively young population. And actually, the danger, like you say, is you get a result from these and then you stretch it to the population it hasn't really looked at. And I think that's such a really important point, isn't it? I totally agree. And maybe that sort of takes us on nicely, Dan, to talk about, you know, we've talked about lower limb, and I know you talked briefly in the editorial about, you know, the other types, sort of fragility fractures of the pelvis, hip and proximal femur. Well, you know, they're much frailer population maybe, you know, and the risk benefit profile is somewhat different. Where is the evidence with that really at the moment, do you feel, Dan?
Yeah, this is probably more in Xavier's territory than mine, but just to comment briefly, I suppose. But we've recently just published another NIHR monograph around the use of risk assessment models to predict which inpatients, hospitalized inpatients, should benefit from pharmacological thromboprophylaxis.
Yeah.
And again, there's detail in there to perhaps, you know, raise eyebrows about the use of risk assessment models internationally. And there's interesting data there on the cost effectiveness of the prophylaxis for all type strategies. Some of that undoubtedly comes from the fact that the risk of VTE almost exponentially increases with increasing age. And not just a reflection of the age, of course, it's a reflection of additional comorbidities, limited mobilization, the likelihood of secondary complications in hospital. So, you know, that frail population with fragility fractures are right at the top end of the VTE risk spectrum. Mm. So, you know, we need to think very, very cautiously about withholding thromboprophylaxis in that population. In terms of the evidence base, you know, my reading of NICE is that it's relatively weak. You know, there are some trials around hospitalized surgical patients and data from those was applied to some of the thinking. But that's one of the reasons that we need DIRECT, I think, which Xavier's trying to move forwards.
Absolutely. Anything you would add to that, Xavier, at all?
No, I think I totally agree with Dan. And this is why population-specific guidance is so crucial. And it's one of the difficulties with trials that have been put together where the populations stray across quite a big risk spectrum because, you know, a relative risk reduction of half. So if you half someone's risk, that means a hell of a lot if your risk is 40%. Mm. It doesn't mean so much if your risk is 0.5%. You know, you go from 0.5 to 0.25. Well, was that worth days of injections? I don't know.
Yeah.
And actually, there's some work from the guys who did prevent clot about how patients value each of the different outcomes and what they would do in terms of which medication they prefer.
Yeah.
How much better it would have to be before they switch from tablets to injections. So that's some really nice background work that put together why they were aiming for the effect sizes they were. But I think population-specific trials are going to be really crucial. Clearly, it's more difficult to recruit to a trial that's got a smaller population, and that's why we need to use somewhat smarter ways of doing trials at scale, which is what we're going to try and do with DIRECT.
Yeah.
And indeed, TILLY, which we'll no doubt come on to talk about in some more detail, is another monster trial.
Yeah.
I think in the arthroplasty space, which is another group, and you know, the hip and knee arthroplasty, a higher risk as well. It's interesting because Gulraj and Mike from Bristol put a lovely meta-analysis together, and they did that back in early 2020, I think. And the sort of upshot was that the risks of bleeding and VTE seem to be quite similar between aspirin and low molecular weight heparin, probably the two leading contenders that we'd like to use in orthopedics, perhaps not shared across all of the medical specialties, but certainly a commonly sought after intervention that we'd like to see in the guidance. But actually, when you look at the confidence intervals around those estimates, they're really quite big, relatively speaking. And so my take from it was that actually that review really helpfully put in place a question, which was, well, is aspirin or low molecular heparin the right way to go for lower limb arthroplasty? And those of you who have read your NICE 2019 can see we're kind of sat on the fence a bit because there seemed to be uncertainty. So we recommended a few options for people. But the Crystal trial came out recently from Australia. We talk about that in the annotation. And this is another top draw trial. So every one of them that we've mentioned in the annotation is really a fabulous study. And I would say to everyone that's got journal clubs, they're all free to download. Just get in there, get into the annotation and go to the links and download the papers and read them and really interrogate them in your journal clubs because they're really top draw. But Crystal is another great trial. It's a cluster crossover. So now we're randomizing hospitals, not patients.
Yeah.
So if you turn up in a hospital and it's randomized to aspirin, you're going to get aspirin. And it's crossover, which means that at the beginning of the study, you get aspirin, and then then the whole hospital moves over to low molecular weight heparin. And you can cross over multiple times, actually. So the whole thing can get quite spicy and difficult to coordinate. But they're beautiful designs, and they really ramp up the power. And so you get a lot of information out. This trial was planned for sort of ballpark 15,000 patients, and they terminated it early. This is really critical. They didn't just stop because they couldn't recruit. They stopped because their independent safety monitoring committee enforced them to stop against some pre-specified safety rules. And that was because the risk of DVT, or proximal DVT and other complications, was three times higher in the aspirin group. So they got stopped by an external independent safety committee. And there's no differences in the bleeding risks either. So they just couldn't complete because they were told stop. And you've got to think, that is a really hard stop. So, and when you look at what the rules were, it wasn't a 5%. It wasn't like our typical p-value where we say we're aiming for 5%. This was down in fractions of a single percent. I can't remember if it was 1 in 1,000 or if it was 1%. You can have a look at that when you review the literature yourselves. But that is a massive, massive margin. And the chances of that occurring due to sampling or some other random error and not being a true difference between aspirin and low molecular weight heparin, I think, is essentially zero.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I personally, and I'm not on the NICE committee, but I would personally be surprised if that does not feature heavily in the next NICE guidance.
And make its way in. I agree. Well, guys, you know, just to finish up, we've mentioned it already, and I think just conscious of time, Dan, I'll come to yourself. We've mentioned it a few times, but we've wound it up now. So we let our listeners know about Tilly, which is about to start.
Yeah, great. So Tilly, I suppose, is the culmination of the work we've done on temporary lower limb immobilization, the NICE research recommendation. I think there was an RCS research recommendation as well, and all of that fed into the NIHR and commissioned a call to try and tackle this problem. And then different ways of approaching it, but we opted for a pair of linked randomized controlled trials with large sample size, because I think, as Xavier has been mentioning all along, you know, these are different subpopulations we want to look at, and we want large, robust levels of data really in the UK population to inform our practice going forward. So we're proposing this pair of trials. We're going to use the TripCast score to ascertain VTE risk and assign people to low or high risk, if you like. And then we're going to have different tiers of interventions for those risk populations. So I'm also representing two different designs, interestingly. In the high risk population, we're really going to be looking at a non-inferiority design, aiming to compare oral anticoagulant agents, either rivaroxaban or apixaban, which is conventional low molecular weight heparin, which is recommended in NICE guidance at the moment, as you know. But the lower risk population, we were quite surprised to see the NIHR commission a trial in that group. You know, our feeling was, well, we need to identify the high risk group and then look at different drugs. Sure. NIHR said, no, you know, we think the evidence base is so weak, it might be that the lower risk group would also benefit, and maybe that patients will find that acceptable. And one of the really interesting things that we discovered when we talked to our patient and public representation group when designing Tilly is their ideas around risk consequence. So we talk a lot about absolute risk, don't we, and relative risk reductions when we're thinking about interventions and trials. Some of the patients, you know, particularly mentioned, well, what is the absolute consequence of that risk? You know, if the risk of VTE is very low, but the consequence of that might be death within 28 days, up to the levels of 10, 15, 20%. I really want to know about that risk, and I want to mitigate it, even if you don't think that's a very high risk. You know, I would like to be told. And that kind of stuff is fascinating, isn't it? I didn't see that coming at all, but we had a really interesting discussion about that, and it informed some of the design, and perhaps that's why the NIHR wanted us to investigate that low risk group. You know, so we're launching that. We've already got 10, I think, pilot sites signed up, which is fantastic, for a 12-month period to look if we can demonstrate feasibility. And then we're looking to expand to 30 sites. So we will hope to be in touch with many of your listeners, I'm sure, and we would really encourage them to participate in generating this evidence base so that we know who this intervention will work in and what the most acceptable version of it is.
That's great, and it's an amazing amount of work as well. I know, to set something like that up and get that information, like you say, it's The PPI stuff is always so fascinating, isn't it? Because it puts a lot of our myths in our own heads to bed. And actually, it's really important what they think, because actually what they've got to live with it. I think that's exactly right. Well, both, I think that's all we have time for. And I wish you all the best. And first of all, thank you so much to you both for taking the time to join us. It was a really great annotation. I found it very, very informative and actually assimilated quite a lot of complex information, data into a really nice annotation and a really clear overview of what can be a really complex talk and really why, you know, we need more data in this area. And I wish you all the best for the trial moving forward. It's been great to have you with us. And to our listeners, we do hope you've enjoyed joining us. We do encourage you to share your thoughts, comments on the various platforms about what you've listened or read in the journal, and feel free to post about anything we've discussed here today. And thanks again for joining us. Take care, everyone.